Coffee House Shots is sponsored by NatWest Group, principal banking partner of the Global Climate Change Summit, COP26, in Glasgow later this year. NatWest is helping its customers reduce their carbon emissions by joining forces with organisations like Microsoft, identifying energy-saving methods for small and medium enterprises. Find out more about their approach to climate change at natwestgroup.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So over the weekend, Alex Salmond has been building his new political party. Katie, can you tell us what's been going on there?
Yes, so this is ALBA, and depending on who you speak to, this is good news for the pro-independence cause, awful news for the pro-independence cause, good news for unionists, or terrible news for unionists. But ultimately, what ALBA seeks to do is to, or at least what they're saying it seeks to do, is to add to the pro-indie voices in Scottish Parliament, in politics, and it's led by Alex Salmond. Now, I think the reason that, for all the talk of the fact that it's going to, you know, be helpful to the cause, there's clearly a sting in the sense that Alex Salmond is not on good terms. Terms of Nicola Sturgeon. In fact, you could, you know, almost political Siberia. We just had the Alex Salmond inquiry, which looked as though Nicola Sturgeon's position could really be in danger. However, she was then cleared on all counts by the independent Hamilton inquiry, so seemed to be almost, you know, at this point where she could move on. Then pops up her predecessor, who wants to be around in Scottish politics for some time to come, is looking for election himself, but also now a few defections from the SNP, two from Westminster, including Kenny McCaskill, the East Lothian MP. And I think the question is really, when it comes to the Scottish Parliament elections, how is this going to impact the race as we see it? Because the SNP have been very focused on winning a majority. We know that will be what they use to push for Indie Ref 2 on. So does this add to that, or does it actually make it harder for the SNP? Now, I think from all the various comments coming from the SNP, they don't seem delighted. I think a regular refrain is, you know, this is the least surprising news, you know. There's almost an implication or an insinuation, these, you know, washed up politicians trying to get involved. But ultimately, I think the question is, and I know James has stronger views on this, so I may hand over to him shortly, which is, given the voting system in the Scottish Parliament elections, this has the potential to increase the number of pro-Indie representatives in the Scottish Parliament, which would clearly be a problem for Boris Johnson in terms of trying to stop the Indie Ref 2, could make it harder. But it also has the potential, if ALBA does fairly well, to actually hurt some of the smaller unionist parties. Not the small, but, you know, lower support unionist parties, may bump a few out. And therefore, I think right now it's really hard to predict where exactly this is going.
James, maybe you can just start by explaining to listeners such as myself how the Scottish elections work and why that can matter for whether or not this party has legs.
The Scottish parliamentary elections take place on two levels. So everyone, when you go to the ballot box, you have two votes. You vote in your constituency and you vote on your regional list. And what happens is the regional list serves to top up parties that don't win any of the constituencies in the region but have a reasonable level of support. Generally, roughly in the Scottish system, it's about 6 or 7% will get you someone elected on the regional list. Now, this is obviously open to being gamed. If, for example, the SNP, who do very well in the constituency thing, urge all their supporters to vote for the Greens, another pro-independence party, you would return far more pro-independence MPs, because if a party does very well in the constituency system, its votes on the regional list essentially don't go anywhere, are wasted. So this is Alex Salmond's argument. He says, I'm just trying to be helpful, I'm not sure Nicola Sturgeon sees it like that, by basically creating another avenue for pro-independence voters to vote for, which would game the system and boost the number of pro-independence MSPs. Now, he is right if a large number of people go vote in their constituency for the SNP on the regional list for ALBA. However, he would be wrong and would hurt the pro-independence cause if what happens is ALBA takes votes off the smaller pro-independence party, the Greens, and makes it less likely that they get top-up MSPs on the list. So in rough terms, on election night, if it turns out that ALBA have got 5% of the vote on the regional list, they have probably hurt the pro-independence cause. If they have got 10%, they have probably helped it not Nicola Sturgeon, but the number of pro-independence MSPs by getting a greater number. I think the other point here is you can't just look at this in terms of how it affects the electoral arithmetic. It is a problem, and the reason I think the SNP have reacted so angrily to this is it is a problem for them for three reasons. First of all, it means that the Alex Salmond business doesn't go away. It is present throughout the campaign with people talking about the Salmond-Sturgeon psychodrama. And as a general rule, voters don't like divided parties. The second problem it does is Salmond knows how to make news. And so whenever he talks, he says something that creates a sense about how the tactics that the pro-independence movement might use. He's already suggested kind of non-violent street protests, that you might open negotiations without a referendum. And all of this is difficult for Nicola Sturgeon, because what Nicola Sturgeon is trying to do is she's trying to appeal to her passionately pro-independence base, for whom independence should have come yesterday, combined with trying to appeal to kind of middle Scotland, who might be open to independence but aren't particularly keen on a referendum anytime within the next 2 years. And so by constantly pushing the mechanisms and tactics of independence up the agenda, what it does, I think, is makes it harder for Nicola Sturgeon to pretend that she is just seeking a kind of doctor's mandate to help Scotland build back better, in that phrase all politicians like to use, post-COVID, which might include independence. You know, that becomes much more difficult. And then I think the third problem for Nicola Sturgeon is I don't think she would be particularly happy if she was woken up to be told that the election results are, well, the good news is there's a pro-independence majority. The bad news is you're dependent on Alex Salmond and his merry band for the numbers, because relations between them have soured to such a point that would make things very awkward. So, you know, I thought there was a kind of wonderful moment of irony when Nicola Sturgeon said this weekend, without any sense of self-awareness, that Alex Salmond's a gambler who likes to make things. And this is a gamble in that, you know, if they get 10%, then he's kind of quids in. If they get 5%, I think, you know, it'll be clear that his political career is over, and it's a rather undistinguished end to it. But I think what she says there, and this I think is the other problem it causes for them, is it reminds people of the stakes. And this is the problem for Nicola Sturgeon, is every time she makes this criticism of Alex Salmond, I think there is a certain proportion of the electorate who think, hang on a second, wasn't Nicola Sturgeon his deputy first minister for years? Didn't she urge all of us to follow him down this independence path? Which, you know, and she's now saying he's a gambler who takes these big risks. And I think all of that element in the air is not helpful to Nicola Sturgeon in this campaign. But I also think anyone who's lived through the last week or few weeks shouldn't underestimate Nicola Sturgeon's ability to get out of even the tightest of spots.
Katie, how has the news been received by voters in Scotland? Do people feel as if he's been washed up and, you know, he should probably just let it go, considering that this comes at the end of his rather failed attempt at getting Nicola Sturgeon out? Or do they think, as James says, you know, this is the person who brought independence right onto the fore only a few years ago?
I think that if you look at personal approval ratings, Nicola Sturgeon's have been much, much higher than Alex Salmond's. Nicola Sturgeon has been slightly dented by what's been happening over the past few weeks, and that has had a negative effect, or it seems to, at least on the SNP, but it hasn't had, it's not as though she's gone down, Alex Salmond has gone massively up. If anything, they seem to just both gone down. Maybe he's brought her down with him. I think they clearly do have work to do if Alex Salmond wants this party to be taken seriously, because you have to remember at the end of the day, while we've all been talking about what Nicola Sturgeon said to who and when, ultimately the reason that this all came about in the first place is because of really serious allegations against Alex Salmond about his behaviour. Now, he has been cleared on those counts, but I think that I don't get the sense that things have moved on to such a point that that whole saga has not been damaging to some degree to him.
I mean, even his lawyer said that, you know, he could have been a better man.
And James, speaking of former leaders, David Cameron has been in a spot of bother recently over his lobbying efforts. Can you tell us about what's going on with the Greensill company?
So David Cameron took a job advising Greensill, and he had kind of lucrative share options of a kind of size and magnitude, I think, that would have created kind of intergenerational family wealth. And the accusation against him is that during the coronavirus pandemic, he kind of lobbied both the government and the Bank of England to try and have Greensill be able to access the various loan schemes that were provided as support. Now, there has been a kind of lobbying inquiry into him. He has been cleared on the basis that because he was lobbying for a company he worked for, he didn't need to register. But I think it does. I think it does raise a kind of tricky question here. I thought Danny Finkelstein, who obviously is close to Cameron, you know, worked close to Cameron on his book, wrote a very thoughtful column about this, which is, what do you do with these people who leave office with so young, with so much more time left? It used to be that politicians stopped being prime minister, and they were frankly so old by the time that they got there that they were quite happy to go off into retirement. I think the problem for Cameron is he feels he has a lot more left to give because of the circumstances in which he left office. It's been hard for him to kind of land some big international job or something like that. I think he very foolishly turned down the offer of chairing the COP26 summit, failing to see that obviously if the US president changed, it would have a much higher chance of success. And then I think the other thing you hear from people is that, you know, he looks at how George Osborne and Nick Clegg have done in their kind of post-office careers, and I mean there is a certain element of keeping score, but you know that, you know, you feel, oh, why have I not managed to do anything like that? And it's also worth remembering that I think what was going to be his great project post-office, which was this kind of UK-China work, has obviously become much more difficult because he would now, if he was doing that, he would now to an extent be kind of actively working against UK government policy, and you know, I don't think he wants to do that. So I think he saw this as a kind of potential payday, but that company has now obviously run into huge amounts of trouble. The Sunday Times did a big piece about what its role in government when Cameron was there, and it does seem an odd idea that basically essentially its business model is that it advances people money before they're paid. And I think the valid argument was that the government shouldn't be advancing suppliers money before they're paid. It should just be ensuring that the government, or in the case of the pharmacy scheme, the NHS, pays people on time.
I mean, Katie, it is an interesting question about what former political leaders should be doing in America. They seem to just go back into politics until they're about 80. But you see with Tony Blair as well that he's really keen to get back into the fray. Well, what do you think is the best way to play that, you know, leaving prime ministerial office?
I think this is one of the probably the rare times on this podcast where we start to praise Theresa May. I think it is interesting, the question of what politicians do, or, you know, prime ministers do when they leave. Now, lots of them want to have, you know, a role on the world stage. I think that it is, I suppose, disappointing how rarely they stick around in the Commons. You can remember that David Cameron said he was going to do this. He used to talk about how he would, you know, continue to be a constituency MP and have a role to play. Cameron was talking about the importance of having parliamentarians with lots of experience in the House of Commons. But yeah, left very swiftly, also, as did George Osborne. Now, I think clearly you can go and have a second, third at that point in career. But I do think having, such as we've seen with Theresa May, the chamber is an interesting dynamic and does add something. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to charting your career outside, it clearly can get murky quite quickly. And I think Tony Blair probably has been one of the most successful prime ministers in terms of forging that career after, but it's been controversial. You look at some of the countries he's chosen to take work with, or some of the governments, that lots of questions are asked a lot of the time, so I don't think it's an easy path over here.
Although on COVID, I mean, the one jab thing was he was the first one in public to have advocated that, so maybe in some ways...
I think in the COVID response, you can see, you can almost sense Blair's frustration that he's not there doing it, and that you know, he has all these views he feels, and you know, and fair credit to him, he has managed to kind of get his oar in the door with the government. You know, the great irony that Boris Johnson, who is so opposed to Blair's plans for ID cards, is now taking up some of Blair's arguments on vaccine passports and immunity certificates and the like. I think there's a difficult question. I think Katie is right. The Commons is a better place for the fact Theresa May is still there. It is a worse place for how few former chancellors and prime ministers there are present. Because there are moments in debate, especially when we are in these unprecedented times, when the benefits of experience would be really great. And I think it is a real pity that there has become a kind of... And I think it's partly because you have to declare your outside earnings. People don't want to do that, so people decide to get out before they have to write it all down, but make it all public. But I do think it is a loss to politics. I mean, all those years when Ken Clark stayed in the Commons, his speech on Budget Day was always one of those moments when you could tell that, you know, other MPs, journalists, people would stop and listen because his knowledge and his experience meant he had things that were worth saying. And I think that, you know, the Commons is a weaker place when you get to a point where people, as soon as they leave office, start planning to leave Parliament itself.
Katie and James, thanks very much, and do join us again for our next episode. Thanks for listening.